race and hate, immigration and enforcement, plus expanding one drug while fighting another. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. One of the leaders of last weekend's violent white supremacy rally in Virginia has been denied a permit to speak at the University of Florida next month. The school rejected the request over safety concerns. Now, Florida is home to the second highest number of hate groups in the nation, with lots of public reminders of the Confederacy. Should those reminders, like statues and street names, be removed? How have local political leaders reacted to a week of tense talk about race? How about you? Meantime, the U.S. Attorney General comes to town to celebrate Miami-Dade and its detention of undocumented immigrants. Plus, while Florida is at the center of the fight over opioid abuse, medical marijuana continues expanding. All that and your input next on the Florida Roundup after the news. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening this week. This week, the University of Florida rejected a request by a white supremacist to speak on campus next month. The speaker was one of the organizers behind last weekend's march in Charlottesville that turned deadly. This week, a white supremacist website based in West Palm Beach was thrust into the spotlight as another racist website was kicked offline. This week, the Southern Poverty Law Center reported Florida has the second highest number of hate groups in the nation. This week, Republican Governor Rick Scott condemned white supremacy and said there was no moral equivalency between white racists and counter-protesters. The governor also had lunch this week with President Trump, and we're told that racial violence and the debate over replacing Confederate monuments were not topics the two discussed. This week, three other South Florida Republican national politicians criticized the president strongly for saying both sides shouldered blame for the violence last weekend in Charlottesville. This week, U.S. Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz called on Governor Rick Scott to declare a special state legislative session for the purpose of replacing one of the Florida statues in the U.S. Capitol. Edmund Kirby Smith was a Confederate general and is one of two statues representing Florida on the Capitol. The other is of the doctor who invented modern air conditioning. This is where we are as this week ends. A rage-filled, deadly demonstration with race at its center ripples far and wide beyond Virginia, again exposing the ugliness of the reality of racism in this country compared to the ideal that we often tell ourselves as Americans. 800-743-WLRN. The conversation begins now. 800-743-9576. Tweet us your thoughts on race, race relations in South Florida at WLRN on Twitter. Nancy Ankrum is the editorial page editor for our partner, the Miami Herald. Rick Christie is along with us, the editorial page editor for the Palm Beach Post. And Manny Garcia is back with us this week, East Region executive editor for the USA Today Network. To all three of you, welcome back to WLRN. Nancy, let's begin with the violence in Charlottesville, but more specifically, how did that resonate here in South Florida?
It resonated in South Florida in many ways, and it brought quite a few local people together. One, there was a vigil for Heather Heyer, who was killed, and various communities, including Miami Shores, which I know specifically, pulled together at least 50 people just overnight. Miami Shores is a diverse community, and pulled together people at a community church to talk about what happened in Charlottesville, to talk about race. You know, you mentioned the ideal that we tell ourselves. Well, a lot of us understand that we are nowhere near that ideal. And so the spectacle and the blood and the death of Charlottesville brought into the open what so many people in this country live with day after day after day, knowledge of such.
Rick Christie, your thoughts from Palm Beach. We saw those counter-demonstrations or memorials crop up on Sunday from Palm Beach County all the way down to Key West.
Yeah, we also had a vigil, I believe, in West Palm Beach as well, with a few dozen people and who also expressed dismay at the events in Charlottesville, and we're calling for unity and peace. I think that, and I agree with Nancy. I wrote also this week, our editorial board did, about the events and what the events of this past week really were teaching us, and that was that one of the things we really need to stop saying is that this is not us. This is not who we are, and just admit, yes, it is who we are. It's not who we want to be. It's not who we should be. And we also need to start turning inward and looking at our own better angels for guidance in what we should do, rather than looking to our moral, looking to our some of our leaders for any type of moral clarity. And I think President Trump kind of taught us that this week.
Manny Garcia, how about your reaction to the events in Charlottesville and the message that it carried throughout South Florida and throughout Florida as a state?
Sure. I can give you more of the perspective in Florida, but also with the USA Today Network, a larger view, because we have a lot of news operations that are in the South and around the country. But I'll give you 2 points for your listeners. One is we've interviewed a fair amount of civil rights leaders and former law enforcement officers who were back in the during the civil rights era protecting protesters and marchers. And they viewed this in a very horrified manner. And it, in essence, it's deja vu all over again when they're seeing folks on University of Virginia campus with tiki torches and the marches and the shouts. So in essence, the message was we're reliving an era, a horrible era from the 60s, and it's time to revisit history and understand what happened back then and how it's playing out in real time on social media today. So that's point A. Point B is we've also done interviews, and we continue to do interviews with surviving World War II veterans. And these are veterans who fought the Nazis as well as liberated camps. And their view is like, listen, we fought and died in order to eradicate Nazism. And this, there's a very inconsistent view of we're glorifying something that is evil and is out to destroy the fabric of our nation. And this is coming from the veterans who fought against evil.
We saw that on social media. We saw that reaction from those World War II veterans, some of those serving in Congress currently today here in 2017 react in that way. Rick Christie, you mentioned President Trump's reaction and then reaction to the reaction and then the reaction to the reaction to the reaction. He had 3 separate statements, of course, on the violence in Charlottesville, one on Saturday, one on Monday, and then another one on Tuesday. How did those resonate with your readers and your audience?
Well, I think that's what I was mentioning in terms of looking to our president for moral clarity. I think the statement that he made on Saturday, which was the initial statement about fault on many sides, upset a great many people, and that was understood by the White House. And when they came back trying to fix this, he read a statement that sounded like it was force fed, and then of course the next day he got into a combative press conference with journalists that, again, he doubled down on his statement from Saturday. And so I think, again, people are rather dismayed and trying to understand and wondering who should they be looking to for some type of leadership out of this, of what Manny was just describing. We're seeing, we're stunned, seeing what we saw back in the 50s and 60s. And folks are wondering, we thought we had come this long way, and now we're seeing that maybe we had not. That this great third rail of race in our society is still as powerful as it's always been, and that we may not be as close or are not as close to solving this issue as we thought we were.
We saw strong and relatively quick reaction, Nancy, from federal politicians from South Florida. Senator Rubio essentially calling on the president quickly to move back from that many sides comment. We saw Representatives Curbelo and Ross Layton as well distance themselves considerably from the president. Those last two have been doing that on a number of issues. Carrying weight with the White House?
Oh, I doubt it. I doubt that. I will say that it is good to hear these representatives of the GOP say these things. And of course, they are not the only ones. There have been Republican politicians across the country, elected officials across the country, who have decried not only the events in Charlottesville, but also the president's just lack of moral force and authority in addressing this. However, let's be clear. This is a party that has nurtured, that has wooed and courted racists among them, racist voters among them, you know, the most I guess, prominent in our lifetimes being Nixon's Southern strategy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But let's be clear that this outburst of white anger and young white male millennial anger is embarrassing. And what are you going to say publicly if you are a person of any kind of conscience? We now have to see if these same people who are decrying Trump mm-hmm. and his words, Republicans specifically, decry efforts to suppress minorities' vote, decry efforts to disable public education, all of which touch minorities in particular, decry specific policies that are, you know, subtly race-based. That will make the difference.
Is there the potential of more local municipal action and reaction? All of this has been, frankly, focused on the federal response and national politician response to the White House and to the violence. We've begun to see some reaction because folks are jockeying for position for political offices in 2018 in Florida. But even further down, Nancy, more of a local municipal response to the kind of violence and displays of white supremacy and nationalism that we've seen in Virginia, with the knowledge that some of those groups are very active here in Florida and, in fact, have targeted Florida.
Right, exactly. And I think there is a role for municipal government, municipal law enforcement in terms of tamping down, ferreting out, preventing violence. However, I think that if the municipalities are really going to play a role, it's going to have to bubble up from residents, from community members, making clear what they want.
Let me bring this down to one specific Florida community that is dealing with this in real time, and that's Gainesville. A lot of folks in South Florida certainly have connections to Gainesville, could be graduates of the University of Florida. Maybe employees could have kids or nieces and nephews or grandchildren going to the University of Florida. This week, the university refused to allow the white nationalist Richard Spencer a speaking permit for an event next month. Let's listen to UF spokeswoman Janine Skikes.
We're very concerned about violence in Gainesville, particularly when there are so many online and social media posts about the next battlefield being in Florida.
UF did not allow this permit over security concerns. Spencer was allowed to speak at Auburn University last year, or earlier this year, after a federal judge ruled that the school could not stop him. There's been some talk about a potential legal threat here. Manny Garcia with USA Today, does the University of Florida have a leg to stand on in this case?
Well, do you see where they're coming from as far as you heard the spokeswoman there about protecting students? And it's a real balancing act because, you know, you're balancing the, you know, you want to give, whether you agree with somebody or not, an opportunity to speak. But at the same time, you know, I think if you're a parent, you want to say, you know, is my child going to be okay? It's a real delicate act where by denying the permit, you're also providing, setting the stage for the, you know, for the organizers of the white supremacists to say, look, this is what's going on. This is why we have no voice and why we're marching. I'm not saying that to justify it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a point I want to touch upon is you're mentioning Gainesville, but also around the state. And one thing that's coming around the country, which I think is going to be a key litmus test. And as you're seeing more of these statues being removed, I think where you're going to see where the politicians will stand on the issue, there's certain states that over the course of years leading up to now, you just can't go into, for example, as was done in Charlottesville or New Orleans, removing or Baltimore, removing these statues. For example, Alabama, South Carolina, and Tennessee have rules, regulations, and statues that you just can't do it. So I think, again, for the listeners, moving forward, part of the litmus test is going to be how these states react as this push goes to remove more of these statues, and also how folks and organizations react, or universities,
yeah,
to balancing the right of protecting students versus an organization, whether you as aberrant as they can be, or a group speaking.
Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post, the two examples that Manny gives there are very tangible examples of how this this race conversation, frankly, argument in some cases, can really manifest itself on university campuses, publicly funded university campuses, as well as the continued treatment and acceptance or not of these monuments. And they're not just statues to Confederate generals and other military folks. It can be street names, as the case is often in some of our communities here in South Florida.
And sometimes even elementary schools or
yep.
public schools.
Yep.
We had that situation in Palm Beach County where a school, Jefferson Davis, was renamed back in 2006. And let me say about the University of Florida. First, full disclosure, I am a University of Florida graduate. Two of my daughters graduated from there, so I'll say that it kind of resonated with me a good mm-hmm. bit. But what's been also big about this issue is that is a free speech issue, obviously, and which to us as journalists is sacrosanct. And but in this case, we actually agreed with President Kent Fuchs when he reversed his decision to deny them the request, and for a couple of reasons. I think Florida's decision, Florida's situation, UF's decision, situation is different from Auburn in terms of, particularly in terms of timing, because unlike Auburn, UF's decision followed Charlottesville, where someone had died, and it also followed days of which our president basically never allowed the carnage and the horror of this thing to subside with his own comments. And because of that, the group, Mr. Spencer's, Richard Spencer's group, I believe it's the National Policy Institute, mm-hmm. Felt emboldened and actually had online, quote unquote, the next battlefield is Gainesville. And so I believe the UF was in a very different position in terms of deciding about the safety and security of the students. It's a tough thing to say that a group should not be allowed to speak somewhere, but when a group like this, these white supremacist groups are inciting violence, and not only are they inciting violence with not just speech, but when somebody comes armed with helmets, shields, torches to what is supposed to be a speech or a rally, that's a whole different thing from what happened, say, for example, back in 1977, that landmark case in Skokie, Illinois, mm-hmm. where the ACLU argued that a Klan group could march through a Jewish community.
And in fact, that march of the Nazis did happen just north of Chicago back in 1977 after that court ruling. 800-743-WLRN is our telephone number. Race relations, speech on campus, and Confederate statues and street names in South Florida. 800-743-WLRN. Let's begin in Westchester, where Oscar has been holding on. Oscar, welcome to the radio. You are on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I just wanted to say first that it's important to look at the history of when these monuments were erected. They were erected in the 50s and 60s, and I think it's important to understand that the context of that time. It's very telling. They've always seemed to act as markers of this nod-nod, wink-wink kind of culture there is in the South about the Confederacy and the identity of the South. I think it's time to put those monuments and statues in museums where they belong. They belong to an era gone by. They belong to a time that we want to always be aware of and remember, but definitely leave in the past. And I think that we should put more modern monuments in their place that do represent the current view of this country and the ideals of the founding fathers, or the ideals of this of the current generation.
So
I'd also like to say,
so Oscar, not to eliminate and put the statues and the memorials in the dump, but to to put them in a museum for...
They definitely have a place in history. That is undeniable. I think everyone can agree to that. They remind us at the same time of one of the biggest mistakes in which, you know, on which, you know, this country was founded on, but we need to be able to leave it in the past. It shouldn't be something that stares at us day in and day out.
Got
as we go to work, or as we go to school, as we enjoy our public parks and public buildings.
Got it.
Oscar, not something we should be proud of.
Gotcha. Thank you for that input. Appreciate it. Manny Garcia, this issue has certainly come up in the state of Florida. As I mentioned, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz has been asking for a special legislative session for lawmakers to finally decide on whom to replace in the National Statuary Hall in Congress by removing Edmund Kirby Smith, the Confederate general, one of the two statues that represents Florida in Congress.
Well, but to Oscar's point, it's Oscar, I'll tell you, and your point's well taken, but in many places, it's not really a nod, nod, and wink, wink. There's a lot of Confederate pride among a lot of Southerners, and, you know, we've seen this from our own coverage across our newsrooms in the South. There's a lot of folks who are very proud of their Southern heritage, and they feel that insulted by the removal of these statues or monuments. Mm-hmm. So it's not a black and white issue. You really have to understand the sense of pride that exists in the South. And now, at the same time, we have a story that's coming out. I think it's going to be on USA Today around what happens to statues that are removed. And where do they go? Apparently, guess what? They end up at the University of Texas at Austin that has a museum or a place where they showcase, and this is where they end up. So there is a place for these monuments, but it's not a black and white issue to the point now. I can't really speak to I know the point that Debbie Wasserman Schultz is trying to make with her push there, but...
I think Nancy Ankrum's got some thoughts on what the congresswoman is trying to do.
Yes, yesterday's editorial had to do with that, and we supported her move. We supported what she's asking for is a one-day special session this fall. Lawmakers will already be in Tallahassee. It's committee week. Right. Committee week, right. As they
prepare. Preparation of the 2018 legislative
Absolutely.
Session.
Absolutely. So they'll all be there, just sit in a room. And, you know, the options are much more representative of who Florida is, what Florida is and should be. Mary McLeod Bethune, who was a civil rights activist, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas.
Leaves of Grass and Everglades.
And George Jenkins, the founder of Publix. And the one thing we did say in the editorial was words to the effect of John Gorey, the inventor of air conditioning, is a true hero.
Yeah.
Don't touch him.
He is the second of the Florida statues at the U.S. Capitol.
Right, each state gets two.
Let's go to North Miami. Jay, you are on the radio. Go ahead, Jay. Welcome.
Thank you for taking my call. I was a student at the University of Florida during the 60s, and with all due respect to your speakers who mentioned the terrible times of the 60s, the 60s was a great time for our country because students and patriots mobilized against segregation, mobilized against the Vietnam War, and millions of students and normal citizens expressed their outrage. So I don't think the 60s were a very productive time for our country. I think we made a lot of progress. And I would say, again, with all due respect, I don't think the issue now is whether or not it's a tricky balance between free speech and allowing permits. I think what our country needs at this point, in my opinion, is a great mobilization like we had in the 60s, to come to the state, to the Capitol in Washington, and put out a 5-million-person march. Let the other groups have their say, but let the mainstream come together and show what the country is really about.
Jay, we hear you calling for a march on Washington, a la the kind of student activism, Jay, that you participated in as a UF alum from the 1960s. Joaquin is with us as well from Plantation. Joaquin, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. I am calling in reference to the First Amendment. A lot has been said in every news station and radio, and everybody talks about the violence that went on in Charleston, in Virginia. However, my opinion is that everybody is entitled to express their opinion. The counter protesters, they came with the intention of blocking these neo-Nazis and KKK groups, blocking them from speaking. And I believe the First Amendment was is part of the Constitution, and the Constitution allows everyone to speak. We may not like, as a matter of fact, I really hate these guys' ways of thinking, you know, Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis. I definitely disagree with them. But they should be allowed to speak. They are Americans nevertheless.
Yeah, Joaquin, I hear you, and I think it brings up a good point, and it's a nuanced point about the First Amendment and our understanding of it, and certainly as four practitioners of it here with four journalists, there are limitations to the First Amendment. There's no doubt about it. There have been limitations that have been put into place, and the ability to speak is not something, in my interpretation, what the University of Florida is doing. It is simply not providing the vessel in which to have Mr. Spencer come and speak. They're not telling him he can't say what he wants to say. He just can't say it here.
Right. And this is Rick. I will say that, one, I don't think in Charlottesville, I don't think counter-protesters were there to stop people from speaking. People were allowed to speak. Things just turned violent between the two groups because, again, a white supremacist and white nationalists, neo-Nazis and KKK, came forward descended upon a city dressed for warfare, for lack of a better term. I will say, though, again, in terms of Florida, you're right. The First Amendment is, again, it's sacrosanct, but it's not absolute. And I think that President Fuchs, in this point, in this case, made the right decision in terms of the First Amendment.
And he is the president of the University of Florida. Manny Garcia with USA Today. Listener asks, is hate speech protected by the First Amendment?
Well, it depends on what you say. I never want to say it's all black and white because, again, so it goes back, from my point, is what I learned in J school. You can't scream fire in a crowded theater.
Right, right. Journalism school, right. Again, yeah. You know, Nancy, the idea here is again, the sanctity of the First Amendment, not the absolute nature of it. And if we're clear on what the University of Florida has said, is it is not allowing Mr. Spencer and his group to congregate on university property for concern of public safety.
Absolutely. And that is their out. And that is a legitimate out. And as far as hate speech being protected, you know, the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, the KKK, they had a permit to gather.
That's right.
Around the statue that they were trying to protect.
And it was a permit that the city of Charlottesville fought against, and a judge stepped in,
right,
and allowed the permit to go forth.
Absolutely. They were allowed to say things like, Jews will not replace us. That, to me, is hate speech. And they were allowed to say that. You are not allowed, and I don't think the First Amendment allows any kind of incitement of violence. Now, I think that violence is one of the tenets of these groups, maybe unspoken, more loudly spoken on their with their websites, Stormfront.
Yep. And, let's talk about Stormfront and online speech and the role that South Florida in Florida is playing here. The Southern Poverty Law Center has found that more than 60 hate groups are based in Florida. South Florida, in fact, is home to the white supremacist website Stormfront. This week, WLRN spoke with Mark Podek. He's a writer and expert on the radical right. He has previously worked with the Southern Poverty Law Center.
I think Stormfront remains a very important fixture on the white supremacist scene. It's a part of the kind of white supremacist institutional superstructure. You know, at the Southern Poverty Law Center, work was done which showed that there were actually 100 murders linked to people who were registered users of Stormfront.
The website is based in West Palm Beach. Rick Christie with the Palm Beach Post. What is it about Florida that's attracted or grown so many hate groups?
Well, I think I would say the weather, but it goes beyond that. I think your guest who spoke earlier in that segment had hit the nail on the head when he said that Florida has clearly lines of division, where you have in South Florida a certain urbanization and diversity of immigrants, more foreign immigrants than you do, say, in Central and North Florida. So those lines are clearly delineated. And Stormfront, which I believe is either in West Palm or in Lake Worth.
I think it's
maybe
in West Palm. I think, yeah.
Yeah, Lake Worth has the left side. They found a home there. And being internet-based, mostly internet-based anyway, they've been able to flourish. But I think what you're seeing now, which is an example of what happened in Charlottesville, is that these groups are now want to be taken more seriously and seen not so much just as internet or web-based phenomenon, but being able to occupy physical space so that they can be more intimidating.
Hmm. What we've seen really with Charlottesville, Nancy, is what had been living in the dark folds of anonymous posts online in some cases saw the light of day.
Well, it currently occupies the West Wing of the White House. And so that is a big thumbs up. That's not a wink and a nod. That's a, you know, go for it, dudes. From the very top, the top elected official in this country.
Speaking of politics, Albert is with us from Coconut Grove. Albert, you are on the radio. Go ahead. Your thoughts.
Thank you, Tom. Great show. Glad that you're doing this. My business takes me all throughout the southeast of the United States. I've been through Montgomery, Birmingham. A Confederate flag the size of almost a football field flies over one of the state roads there from the Sisters and Daughters of the Confederate. After the Confederate flag controversy, I've gone through all the state of Florida. I've seen most of those monuments in Jacksonville, Ocala, Gainesville, and it emboldened the folk that carry the Old Dixie. They were flying it high, riding in the back of their trucks almost to a face the cause of bringing down the Confederate flag. But that's state politics, which our state is, the North is not the South in any light. It's completely different country. But when you get to Miami, you know, I'm from Cuban descent and old guard from the 60s. They came into the United States. And the reality is back then, blacks and whites didn't really commingle. It was a class society. It's not necessarily that they were racist per se. There were racist undertones, and it was class-driven. And I saw that in real life. We didn't mix. You know, it just didn't. It was always you over there, them over there. And that's how it was. It's sad, truth, but that's how it plays out in hyper-local politics down here. And I'm wondering, now that this debate has been brought up, and we're in an election cycle from commissioner races all the way through to the mayor's races, are the public and the media, local, hyper-locally here, going to take our potential politicians here that are putting themselves through the election to task and ask them where they stand on these issues? Because whether you're Democrat or Republican, if you're a Republican and you're fighting for hyper-local politics, which is usually a nonpartisan position, you have to take a stand on this. And does that mean that you still play cover for Trump's economic policies?
Albert, let me ask you the specific questions you'd ask of these local government candidates are related to memorials and street names that acknowledge the Confederacy.
I would think that is just the edifice, right? That is the result of placating. Everybody has the right to put anything on their private property. When it when it's large enough or integrated into public spaces, it becomes a political question, and it's about their willingness to address law that has already been resolved. We already went through a civil war. We addressed it. It's not like there is a Confederate nation out there that has reconciled, like Germany, that their policies were wrong and we're taking a better course now. The Confederates disbanded. It's done. For to fly it in public spaces or to give honor to that in public spaces, it fosters something wrong. And moreover, when the leadership of a particular party emboldens that side, where are our hyperlocal leaders to stand up and speak truth to power?
Albert, we hear you.
Regardless of party.
Albert from Coconut Grove, great question about hyperlocal politics here toward this. Nancy, your thoughts?
You know, I think Albert is absolutely right. And we have seen this kind of agenda creep over the years on the editorial board as we do interview candidates for a variety of positions. And we just in the past, oh, I'd say 5-6 years, we have been much more cognizant of bringing national politics into our questioning of candidates running for state office, running for local office. Of course, the presidential election, we definitely had to find out where people stood, and we will again with this.
Well, speaking when national politics comes to town, still to come as the roundup will continue after this, the U.S. Attorney General came to congratulate Miami-Dade County this week for working with immigration authorities. So will the federal dollars now follow? We will talk about immigration and enforcement next on the roundup, 800-743-WLRN. Back. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. By the time U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions visited Miami this week, 174 people had been detained in a Miami-Dade jail and turned over to federal immigration agents since late January. That practice was why the nation's top prosecutor was in Miami this week, praising the county for ending its sanctuary city status earlier this year.
To all sanctuary jurisdictions across this country, I say Miami-Dade is doing it, other cities are doing it, and so can you. Work with us. Please help us enforce a lawful system of immigration.
7 months ago, County Mayor Carlos Jimenez reversed several years of policy and began honoring immigration and customs enforcement requests to keep immigration suspects in county lockups for up to an extra 48 hours. Previously, the county would only do that if the feds paid for that extra time behind bars, which it did not. The county commission eventually voted to endorse this change. Now, President Trump has threatened to pull federal funding from municipalities offering sanctuary, and earlier this month, the Department of Justice officially notified Miami-Dade County is no longer a sanctuary city. So that led to the visit this week and the Attorney General making it official the county will continue receiving an annual $500,000 police grant. So immigration, enforcement, detentions, and funding now. Do you support sanctuary or local jails working with immigration authorities? How does the threat or promise of funding impact all these decisions? 800-743-9576. Immigration is up next here on the Florida Roundup. The phone number, 800-743-WLRN. Nancy Ankrum, editorial page editor for the Miami Herald. Rick Christie does the same up at the Palm Beach Post. And Manny Garcia is the East Region executive editor for the USA Today network of publications. Nancy, what kind of reception did the Attorney General receive when he came to Port Miami?
Well, it was not an official reception. County Mayor Carlos Jimenez, I think, was the only elected official who showed up. And I think the absences spoke volumes, even though this commission did vote to support this new policy. You know, Jimenez, I think, decided to dance with the one that's in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And it is, and editorially, we supported it. However, we really pushed that middle way, that not every undocumented immigrant is a criminal. And you know, again, you could hear in Sessions' quotes the push of fear, these criminal aliens, these criminal immigrants.
Well, there was
immigrants.
A real contrast he was trying to draw between Miami and its change in sanctuary city policy and the city of Chicago, where Rahm Emanuel, a longtime Democrat, former congressman, former chief of staff for President Obama, has pushed significantly against the immigration policies of the current administration.
Right, absolutely. And what we have always urged is to draw a distinction between, yes, criminal, unlawful, undocumented immigrants. Yeah, get rid of them. And people who are here, who are law-abiding. And look, this all stems from the from Congress punting for more than 8 years in bringing about a common-sense federal immigration policy.
But, Rick Christie, Miami-Dade is a little bit of an island, certainly within the South Florida Big Three counties in terms of its reversal of this acquiescence to federal detention requests when it comes to immigration. Palm Beach and Broward were vocal earlier this year in saying that they were welcoming areas for immigrants.
Yeah, I think our Sheriff Bradshaw basically said nothing. It was changing regarding how we handle criminal undocumented. And West Palm Beach, actually, our largest city, has been very vocal mm-hmm. about being a sanctuary city. And we've taken the same position as the Miami Herald in terms of the way that our undocumented are treated, that undocumented criminals are one thing, but picking up people who have been here for years, who are not criminals, who are working, some people who even have started businesses, mm-hmm. when they check in the way they're supposed to be with ICE and detaining them, that is not the way to go at all.
Manny Garcia with USA Today Network, the response in Florida, an immigration-heavy state, obviously, but one who's top of the ticket in the governor's office and the legislature have been very friendly with the Trump administration.
Correct. Now, boy, this is one of these questions that has, or topics that has my head spinning because there's so many threads to it. So first of all, I covered and oversaw coverage of the city and the county for years when I was at the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. Mm-hmm. The topic of sanctuary cities was never like top of mind in everything happening at the county. And so you start with that. And then at one point when Carlos Alvarez was director of Miami-Dade Police, he said he wasn't going to do the work of the feds. So you've got a change going on here, but, you know, we've got a state that really depends on workers, oftentimes who are not documented, to work in factories, constructions, agriculture. In the state of Florida, we have done stories and talked to developers and, frankly, general contractors who say, without these workers, we will not get homes built. So how are you going to just come up and pull everyone out? So, that's for starters. And then so Sessions comes in here. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger issue that we have here, if Sessions was going to address something, is I want to tell you, as someone who grew up in Miami-Dade County, the racial and economic disparity, no, I should just say for Miami-Dade County, but it's very acute here, is staggering. Racial, economic, transportation. And if your listeners want to go no further, not that they have the time, but go one morning to Bond Court in Miami-Dade mm-hmm. County or go to Mag Court in federal court. You tell me that there's, you want to see disparity in race, economic, go look at the morning courthouse in state and federal. You're going to see what the real problem is.
Manny Garcia is the East Region Executive Editor for USA Today Network. Manny, I know you've got to get out here while the program will continue, but we thank you for your time today and your input. Thanks so much. I do want to go to line four for a quick comment from Miguel in Miami regarding immigration and enforcement. Miguel, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Now, I just recently heard of an incident of some young kid overstayed his visa, has been checking in on a yearly basis, and just recently he checked in and been detained and is being deported. Now, is someone overstaying their immigration? Is this what Sessions considers a dangerous criminal? People that are overstaying? I mean, apparently they're breaking the law, yes. But is this some sort of a criteria to deport someone?
It is becoming clear. I mean,
Yes. I mean, Miguel, to your earlier point, overstaying a visa is against the law.
Right. Exactly.
And in this environment, Nancy and Rick, the administration and the Department of Homeland Security and ICE have been interpreting the letter of the law, whereas under the Obama administration and previous administrations, it was looked at with the spirit.
Right. There's no nuance with this administration, and it really needs to dawn on everybody, including undocumented immigrants, and I think it has, that there is no wiggle room. At the same time, there doesn't seem to be any consistency. People are on tenterhooks because they just don't know. Is someone coming for me? Is someone not? I've got my wife. I've got my kids. I've got my job.
And what we'll hear from law enforcement, Rick, we've heard from law enforcement, I'm sure you as well, is situations that this has harmed communication with law enforcement, especially in immigrant communities, regarding very serious crimes. It could be domestic battery, could be sexual abuse, where folks and family members and others perhaps do not go to report those kinds of crimes for fear of being found out that another family member or somebody else is overstaying an immigration visa.
Well, absolutely. We've had police chiefs in Palm Beach County tell us this, that that this increased, as Nancy said, lack of nuance on this particular issue anyway for the administration has made their jobs that much more difficult when it comes to these communities. And this is after, I want to say, Tom, this is after years of working hard to develop relationships with these communities, these communities of color, really, to help make these communities more safe, to get them to trust law enforcement here in the U.S. because they come from countries where obviously they can't trust law enforcement. So and so they've been working on this for years. In particular, our police chief in Jupiter, Florida, in the north part of the county, who has worked really hard at this, was lamenting the fact that they are not getting calls the way they used to just a year ago from people in the community who were asking for help. And I want to say on a side note that even in terms of business, I was talking to someone who said that they're not seeing the business they were seeing in terms of something as small as quinceañeras. Because people are not, we're afraid to hold these types of events, which are basically birthday parties, afraid to hold them because they were afraid that if they have this group of people in one place, that they could be subject to raid.
Basically birthday parties, but so much more than that, Rick. So much more.
I'm sorry, but I was just in a small example.
Understood. Jose, you've been holding on in line two in Miami. Jose, your thoughts. Go ahead. You're on the radio.
Yes. Well, the last time that I saw my mom in the United States was actually at a court hearing, and she was wearing orange jumpsuits. I was about 16 at the time. And she was supposed to be released that day, but because of an immigration hold, she was actually placed immediately into deportation proceedings and sent back to Nicaragua. And that moment, I will never forget, because obviously it was the last time that I saw her here. And it's, these type of policies are having a real impact. I was actually placed into the foster care system because I had no mother at the time. And now I'm 22, without a mom here in the United States. And so this is real, and it's having an impact. And it's not really – it's discouraging our families from reporting crimes as well.
Are you documented now, Jose?
Yes, I'm on road. I'm going to become a citizen in December. So I'm going to make sure that I'm going to get my – I'm registered to vote and make sure my friends vote. And so this doesn't continue to happen.
Well, congratulations, Jose. Thank you for sharing your personal story. Nancy Ankrum, how much more will this Miami-Dade example, do you think, be held up by the Attorney General and, for that matter, the Justice Department and the administration against other communities and, frankly, pitting communities like Miami presumably against communities like Chicago for federal resources.
Right. I do think that that is their MO in this case, to get resistant communities, resistant municipalities to fall in line. And they are willing to do it by holding the purse strings. They are also willing to do it by setting someone up as the role model and the goat.
And we have to look no further than South Florida to find the variety of responses to the immigration enforcement requests from the federal government that we've seen in Miami-Dade compared to those responses in Broward County and Palm Beach County as well. Nancy Ankrum is the editorial page editor for a partner of the Miami Herald. Nancy, always great to have you on the Roundup. Thanks so much.
Love it.
And Rick Christie with us, editorial page editor at the Palm Beach Post. Rick, always great to hear your thoughts, too. Thanks so much.
It was good to be here, Tom.
And our thanks as well to Manny Garcia, who was with us earlier. He's the East Region editor, executive editor for the USA Today Network. Finally on the Roundup, it's been 99 years since something like what will happen Monday has happened, a total solar eclipse visible coast to coast across the United States. Now here in South Florida, we will see the moon cover about 80% of the sun Monday afternoon, begins just after 1:30, the maximum coverage coming just a few minutes before 3 o'clock. Now, of course, the only safe way to view the eclipse is not with sunglasses or homemade eclipse viewers. You need special filters. Do not look directly at the sun. That'll do it for the Florida Roundup this week. It is produced by Bridget O'Brien and Gina Jordan. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our digital director is Teresa Frontado. News director Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman, our editorial director. Our program director, Peter J. Maritz. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for calling. Thanks for listening.